Hello and welcome to the News Club podcast, where we talk about the news and more importantly, what to do about it. This season, we're speaking with people, the rebel citizens, who aren't just talking about the headlines, but actively working to rewrite what comes next. I'm your host, Em, and today it's just me and Chivers, who, if you've heard any of these episodes before, you'll know. So who is Dr. Tom Chivers? Well, you're a researcher and campaigner specialising in UK media policy with a focus on sustaining the public value of public service broadcasting in the face of new technologies, shifting audiences and changing markets. Presently policy lead at the Media Reform Coalition, having worked on reforms to BBC funding and independence, campaigned against Channel 4 privatisation, influenced the UK Media Bill and co-authored the Media Reform Coalition's flagship, Who Owns the UK Media Reports. You're also a co-author of our mutual friend, the BBC in the Digital Age, a briefing that sets out how to transform the BBC into a public service mutual founded on genuine democratic representation and participation. Now, we've alluded to this many a time, and this is going to be the focus of our conversation today, finally honouring it, giving it the moment, giving it the spotlight it deserves, because this shit's so cool. It's so cool. I've also just discovered, and I don't know why I didn't clock this, but you have a PhD and therefore you are a doctor, and that is funny to me.
Someone said this may be like one of those crappy apocryphal things that they say to like make PhDs feel better, but I think the concept of doctor applied to PhD before it did to medical doctor. That may be like complete bullshit, but it's like we were here first sort of thing. When you say like, oh, you're a real doctor, or you're like an academic, or no, I'm the real OG doctor, a PhD.
But yes, that could sir. Just be I remember when I was a kid, always wanted to, I don't know why I wanted to have a doctorate in, I just wanted one. Because I was like, if I get one, people will henceforth refer to me as Dr. X, you know what I mean? And I quite liked that. I was like, fuck this Mr. and Mrs. patriarchal bullshit.
Yeah.
You know, my little like angry self that like hates gender or whatever. It's like, don't want it. Don't do that.
I was in a good position. I think I'd already come into doing the PhD knowing that like titles are bullshit anyway, because before even doing like my master's degree, I'd gone on a holiday with my family, and like for some part of the holiday process I had to like enter my details manually, and it had the drop down box for like, I'll pick your title, so enter your name and pick your title, and the list was like 60 items long because it included pastor, reverend, brigadier general, all of like the official titles of state that go right back to like the 1800s, and I picked commodore as a joke, thinking that like, oh, this isn't really going to matter. And then when all the documents came through for this holiday, it was all listed as like Commodore Tom Chivers. And I was like, oh, this is all bullshit then. You could literally just fill in a box saying, oh yeah, I'm Commodore, I'm Reverend, esteemed third Marquis of the Saint-Eustache. And it's like, they won't give a fuck anyway. So I went into the PhD knowing that like, you know, it's not going to change your life being able to put doctor. It's going to be useful for like academic work, but it's not going to change your life being able to walk around and say, actually, I'm Dr. Tom Chivers, and you must refer to me as my actual title, which has been awarded to me by a university that may not exist in 10 years, going
in
by the
years.
Current state of the sector. Yeah, the sector's collapsing, isn't it? Fucking money's all disappearing out of it. So, and places
who's
like Goldsmiths, who's taking it?
Yeah.
A big black hole of lack of funding, that's what's taking it.
But where was the funding coming from originally?
What, for universities?
Mm-hmm.
The public purse, as a public investment in the good nature of education. And
I thought you guys paid $9,000 for uni though.
That was only as of like 2010, right? So Blair started to introduce tuition fees as a way of like starting to marketize university income, and then the Cameron Osborne cuts from 2010 were like, we're going to increase the amount that we can monetize university tuition fees at the same time as massively reducing the public money going into university. So like the scales were moving in completely opposite directions. The public funding for universities went down, the private funding required by individual students went up. So like there's just been massive black holes at every single university. And unless you were already a huge established like Oxford, Cambridge Research Institute, where a lot of your money came through from like private enterprise coming in and saying, we want you to research cure for cancer, then it was very difficult for a lot of like, I don't know, there's probably like a better name for them, but like mass enrollment universities that are just like open to ordinary students who just want to come and study stuff they like, instead of specifically being a medical doctor or a physicist. It's like, hey, if you want to come and study Assyrian basket weaving or feminist literature, there's a place you can come and do that, and it will cost you a princely sum of £9,000 a year. But don't worry, there's this whole like syphilitic loan system you can get involved in, where you know, other than, because yeah, there used to be all things like maintenance grants and loans and stuff. Anyway, completely different conversation from what we're supposed to be talking about.
But fascinating nonetheless. Collapsing.
Yeah, and it also, I guess it does matter a bit for like how ideas about the future of media get generated, because so many of them have come from, I mean, not just academia, but like academia is the place where like people can sit back and look at what has happened to the media sector. Why is it falling apart? What's wrong with it? What might a different system look like? And what kind of ideas and proposals and structures could you put together? And a lot of that stuff is done not by academia, but via academia. Like academia is the space where those ideas can sort of percolate and be generated into something and then spread out to civil society. And if that goes, then like we're just going to have this whole disassemblage of random activists saying... And also, there'll be like no actual space to discuss them, because there won't be any pipeline to actually think, if I want to talk about how to change the media, where do I go to do it? And the media will be fucked. So you won't be able to talk about it in the media.
So no more Goldsmith's pipeline.
No more Goldsmith's pipeline.
God damn it. Well, it is a shame, but let's go back to the story of you, how you came to be, how you came to make this happen, and how we are going to change and completely transform the BBC, guys. All right. So, well, actually, let me ask you the question I'm asking everyone first. So what should be headline news but is in? I don't know why I said it like that.
Yeah, there's lots of stuff which is news but not headline news around Gaza, obviously, which just feels like the absolutely definitional story of our time. In so many ways, not just in terms of the horrible atrocities and violence that's going on in Gaza, but then so many of the failures of our supposedly political and democratic structures that it's revealed. And in the media as well, like the number of people who are just so obviously cognizant of the failures of the mainstream media and the BBC especially, to treat the realities of what's going on in Gaza with any sort of seriousness or accuracy or truth or even like basic humane interest, I think is a story which is apparent to so many people. But because of the failures of the structure of the media itself, it's not getting that sort of awareness more broadly. There is not this is the nature of all these institutions. There's no introspection from the journalists and the editors who are perpetuating this cycle of like, what would you call it, like communicative violence against Palestinians and pro-Palestinian supporters and anybody who gives a fuck about what's happening.
Communicative just, violence?
Yeah.
That's an interesting term. I like that.
Yeah, so this idea of like the way you are spoken about, the way you are conceived of in public debate demeans you and diminishes you as a human being in a way that like you just do not have the same sort of presence or rights as anybody else through the way in which you are discussed. I mean, this is the essence of like all critical media, radical media criticism, is the way in which the framing of news stories, the language and presentation of different people and their interests is a form of, you know, in a very sort of wanky academic way of talking about violence, but a form of violence that diminishes and harms people, right? It may not be whacking you over the head with a big stick, but it's like an actively harmful thing to how you experience life, particularly like within the last 100 years of human civilization, where so much of like the way we conceive of reality and our place in it and how we communicate with one another has gone beyond like, do you live in the same village and talk about whether the harvest is going to work? And now you like can see yourself or possibly not see yourself represented in the media, in television, in news, in art and culture. And
I'm curious
the way
to know-
that like, no, go on.
Sorry. I'm curious to know what you have to say also about the BBC's role presently in that, in as actors who are pushing a certain narrative and who are committing the same, what did you call it, communicative violence. Because I think that might help lead us onto what this mutualization offers in light of this.
As in, why does the BBC in particular do it?
Yes.
I think part of that goes to, I mean, that's a very, very long story. I think the short version of it would be that because of changes in how the BBC as an institution have taken hold over the last, let's say, 30 years, which is quite a, like, people who are aware of the history of the BBC sort of talk about it in terms of like decades rather than like months or years, just because of the way like its constitution works. But I think the combination of the BBC always being a beast of the state and always having those like tentacular connections with government power, elite power, corporate power, through the way that corporate power has itself like phased itself into the operations of the state. That's like one part of the pillar that explains why the BBC has been so appalling on Gaza and Palestine, because being appalling on Gaza and Palestine has been the policy of the British government, and the BBC as like the sort of mirror image of what the British state and British elites want to see in the country is the reason why it's reflected that. I think more in like a kind of practical way of like BBC journalism, the actual daily output of the BBC, why it reports stories in particular ways, why it talks about Palestinians, or even doesn't talk about Palestinians in a way that massively dehumanizes them, why it completely accepts uncritically and regurgitates Israeli and IDF narratives about what's going on and the explanations for why they have bombed this tent filled with starving Palestinians. I think those more practical justifications go down to, as I say, the changes in the last 30 years where actually the operation of the BBC as a media organization has become more and more like the rest of commercial media and corporate journalism, in that it is just about how do we produce a story as quickly as possible? How can we get a headline out there that is then put in front of as many people as possible, originally on television and now on like social media outlets, to just say, we're at the front of the news agenda because we've produced this story. And the way that we construct what is the most important piece of news, who are the most important people to speak to, has been guided more and more by those kinds of commercial ideas of news in terms of what sells. Now, obviously, the BBC isn't selling stuff, but it uses that same formula of like, how can we get eyes on the page? How can we get
people interested?
Right,
the attention economy, yeah.
Yeah, the attention economy, right? It's just how, what is the way that we need to present this story in a way that like sells or gets people's attention? And there's this sort of, I don't know what you'd call it, a bit of a feedback loop between the BBC and the corporate press, where actually in terms of a feedback loop, the BBC is always like the bottom player in that. But like through the commercialization of their internal structures, through the managerialization, the way that so many of like the BBC's operations now have to go through managers rather than like through actual creative people interested in producing news, the BBC basically copies the operations and the interests of the corporate press. And you see this all the time on like It's Breakfast, It's Morning Breakfast show, or on Question Time, or any kind of basic current affairs program by the BBC, where they'll say something like, what's in the news today? And they will then go and look at the front pages of the major corporate newspapers. Now, 40 years ago, that would have made sense, because newspapers used to be read by millions and millions of people, and they were the way, in tandem with like the BBC's own journalism and investigation, which of course was so seeped in like the power of the state. The combination between like the BBC as this austere but mostly state-led institution and the mass popular tabloid and broadsheet newspapers read by tens of millions of people every day, it wasn't a good way of running the news, but it sort of made sense in at least, okay, well, these are read by lots and lots of people, so that may be some way of discovering the news. A very bad way of thinking about how to discover the news, but like a way that was done nonetheless. The fact that the BBC still uses the corporate press as like its primary source of thinking, what are the important stories? Like, going back to your question, if you were to ask like a BBC presenter what should be in the headlines today and isn't, they would be like, well, let me open the Daily Mail and go to page 8 and see what like the third story in the Mail is. And it's like, well, that's in a corporate newspaper and you're just regurgitating it. You're not like, there's no sense of thought or like opinion leadership within the BBC anymore. They do not see themselves as like a national institution that is there to discover the needs and interests of the public. Not that they ever did, but like that's written in their charter. They're supposed to do that. Like, they do not see their role as being a major national institution for public opinion formation and political discussion. They see themselves as basically just a reflection of the news industry, the horrible, corrupt, fetid news industry dominated by Murdoch and Rothermere and big corporate giants. So to loop that back around to Gaza, I think, again, as like the foundational issue of our time, and then kind of, you know, unfortunately having to separate ourselves from the reality of like the death and violence and starvation and imprisonment and occupation of Palestinian life and Gaza especially, and the expansion of settlements in the West Bank, all the horrible things that are going on. When we remove ourselves like a couple of steps from that and look at what is the media's role in this, I think the sort of the progressive wilting of the BBC as a powerful but corrupted state institution into a weak but even more corrupted corporate institution of just the whole way that the news industry sees itself as just a regurgitator for whatever Murdoch or Rothermere want on their front pages, and how that links into all of the BBC's connections with state power, military power, elite authority, I think is just so much at the core of explaining why the BBC especially is so abysmally bad on Gaza. Because on one hand, it's copying the state, and then on the other hand, it's copying the corporate press. And those two things combined together make for very, very bad, shit, harmful news about the realities of Gaza and Palestine.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what's what. Now, I really want to dive into a bit more as to like, well, the solution, you know what I mean? Like what we're offering, what you're offering. But I'm also curious to know, backtracking a bit, you know, at your time in Goldsmiths, this was your focus, right? BBC Charter, BBC mutualization. Why was that the case? What motivates you? Why do you do this work still?
I think it goes back to, and this is a bit of a tangent, but it does all come together, is when I started out as a student was just when the phone hacking scandal had happened, when the Millie Dowler revelations that the News of the World had not just been hacking celebrities, but been hacking victims of crime, victims of murders, the families of dead children, the families of people who had been involved in terrorist incidents. That was then what exploded the phone hacking scandal into this major reckoning for how shit the corporate press had been. And seeing that unfold when I was a student and recognizing like, oh, like this is the collapse of a major industry, which is supposed to be like, you know, all of these fourth estate ideals, holding power to account, representing the public's needs and interests. And no, it's just like this massively corrupt, broken system of disgusting, horrible journalists going out to ruin people's lives to make money. So watching that unfold when I was a student and then encountering the arguments of like, well, how could you not have that happen? How could different structures or regulations or ways of organizing the news industry work that could have prevented hacking, that could have made a more independent, accountable, higher standards, more trustworthy system of news in the press? And that was the MRC. That was the beginnings of the MRC and the hacking scandal, was academics who had always been interested in the imbalances of power in the media industry, rightly saw the Leveson inquiry as the opportunity to address all those failures, and were very fortunate. I mean, basically, people involved in the Hacked Off campaign and some people who were involved in the MRC were the ones who made the Leveson inquiry happen, because the swirl of politics at the time was David Cameron saying, well, we mustn't do this wide-ranging investigation into Murdoch because there's criminal cases going on. We have to wait until the criminal cases are done before we investigate this. And very clever people, much cleverer than I, were pointing out, why don't you separate it into two? You don't have to deal with the criminal stuff. You can look at the culture and the practices and the ethics of the press now. Because if you don't look at it now, they'll all clean shop and tidy up and delete all the evidence and find their right arguments. So being able to pin down Rupert Murdoch or Piers Morgan or all of these scummy reporters who were involved in hacking dead, murdered teenagers' phones was like a real political success, to actually overturn what was the dominant political instinct of the government at the time, which was to do nothing, and to force them to do an inquiry that was so explosive and exposed so much and confirmed so much about what researchers and commentators and the general public assumed about the newspaper industry. So that's a very, very long tangent to say that like my interest in media policy came from seeing not just the explosion of what was very clearly a failure of media policy, a failure of press standards and proper journalism, but then like a big debate on how could it be done differently? What should a more accountable, effective system of encouraging high standards of journalism be? Then big gap of me just being like a student and an academic doing lots of pieces of research. And then coming to thinking, well, if I did a PhD, if I wanted to do my own sort of original analysis of the massive imbalances of power in the media system, how those imbalances of power corrupt and pervert our political system, and that in turn creates media policies which don't benefit the public but only benefit the concentrations of power and interest, what would an interesting piece of research be to explore how the dynamics of like concentrated media power affect our politics and affect the kind of policies that are made about the media? So my PhD was partly looking at how the phone hacking scandal happened and how the political and policy responses to phone hacking unfurled, but then comparing that to BBC Charter Review, which is also this other major space of deciding how we distribute power in the media system. We have this huge national institution with enormous power over culture, art, news, music, radio, TV, all the things that we know the BBC should be very important for. And there is this debate called Charter Review, where once every 10 or so years, politicians sit down and they decide, well, what should the BBC do next? The idea that like, oh, you know, hands off the BBC is obviously not true. But then Charter Review comes along, and it's this kind of like moment where the door opens a tiny little bit. There's this opportunity where people other than government ministers and other than BBC elites and other than corporate lobbyists might have a chance to influence what the BBC is, what the BBC does, and how it works. But at the same time, that doesn't happen in a vacuum, right? There's not just, oh, we'll all sit down and have a nice debate about Charter Review. It is happening in a political and media environment that is still dominated by massive corporations and massive vested commercial interests and horrible bastards who hate the public and hate the public interest. So how does Charter Review then become this like encapsulation of all these different swirls of power and interests, and who wants to like govern? If the BBC is there for all of us, how does it end up to be in such a shit state where less than 10 years after the last charter, it is now completely in hock to the narratives and agenda of the British military and in many ways the Israeli state, right? The BBC has basically been factored out as a propaganda arm of the Israeli state over the last 2 years. So my PhD was, what were these two processes of decision-making about two major media institutions, the corporate press on one side and the BBC on the other? And how did those different spaces of decision-making play out? Who were the key actors? How were the decisions made? What were the different interests and ideas that came into that process? How involved was the public in these processes? When everybody says that independent journalism is so important to the public, or that the BBC is a public service broadcaster, how involved was the public in either of these processes? I don't think anybody listening will be surprised to hear, not very much at all. But why was that? What were the actual, like, you know, the structural reasons are a big part, but like actually the practical reasons as well, like what were the individual conversations and processes of decision making? You have this thing called Charter Review, which is just like this term. How does that then become an actual set of like new regulations and definitions and instructions for the BBC on what it should do and all those bits in between? My supervisor described it as like, how's the sausage made? Right? We all know that, like, on one end of the process you have a pig and at the other end of the process you have a sausage. What goes on in the abattoir slurry producing sausage factory? How does the pig get turned into a sausage? What are the different cogs and freshers and conveyor belts that actually turn the pig into the sausage? Apply that to decisions about how should the media be organized? How should it work to further democratic interests? How should it serve citizens and the public? And instead of just being like a massive patsy for corporate interests. So that was what my PhD tried to do, was actually go into the sausage factory of media policy and like actually identify who were the real, not just like it was corporate lobbyists, but like who were the corporate lobbyists? Who were the actual named people?
Who were the actual named people?
Yeah, who was like actually responsible for, you know, deciding which bit of text went into the charter? Who came up with this idea of, you know, in the last BBC charter, the word distinctiveness was one of these like annoying terms which eventually became the guiding principle for the BBC. Where did that word come from? Who said that word first? And how did it come to be the thing which completely has defined for the last 10 years the regulation and market structure of the BBC as a public service broadcaster? That was, to me, like, because again, I think people, particularly people like in radical political spaces who recognize that the media is shit, we all know instinctively that the way decisions about the BBC are made are massively flawed, only really benefit the powerful and the elites. But I wanted to understand, well, how does that happen? We know instinctively that happens, but how, really? And I think it's only by like unearthing those relationships and directly pointing the finger at real people and saying, this named person came up with that term distinctiveness. These people were the ones having private meetings with David Cameron to make sure nothing changed after the phone hacking scandal. These are the guilty people of history, right? So it was partly a big cathartic exercise of like, everything's really shit in the media. And a lot of people just go, oh, it's because of elites and lobbying and corporate interests, which is true. I want to know actually who. He wants to know
what's happening in the sausage factory.
I want to know who had their hand on the crank of the sausage factory, or who, like, you know, who stopped it from being a nice, as much as you can with a mashed up pig. Who is the one that stopped the pig from becoming a nice, ethically fair trade pepper and apple sausage instead of like,
you know,
the disgusting
loved, cared for, living a full life beforehand?
Yeah, a loved, cared for pig before its head is chopped off and it's run through a fresher. Yeah.
Jesus Christ. You know, I wanted to name this episode after, you know, the theme and the topic. And now I can't let go of the fact that I want to name it something like Sausage Factory, Sausage Party. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Don't name it anyway, Sausage. Have you seen Sausage Party?
I know, that was the point. You know,
it's awful.
It's attention grabby. It's provocative. It's like, ooh, what's happening? And turns out, bah, we're talking about BBC mutualization. Gotcha.
Yeah, surprise. You thought this was going to be a movie review episode, and it's actually about regulatory structures of public service broadcasting.
I mean, we've just had an episode on regulation already, and we're going to do another one. But I guess it goes to show how important it is. More than I thought it was, maybe a few years
ago. Yeah,
I couldn't have given a fuck before, but I care now. Yeah. I care. You got me caring. You guys got me caring.
You now understand the difficult task we have of, like, it takes long conversations to it take does. People from that position of, like, being...
like, so indifferent to,
People are not... I don't think people are indifferent to it. I think they're angry about it. They really are angry about the fact that the media is shit. But the way that the problem of media power, concentrated elite media power, is, like with so many other things in our broken society, it allows to fester this impression that nothing can be changed. This is the way things have to be. Like, we just have a massively oligarchical corporate press that's operated by journalists with no scruples, no ethics, who will happily go out and murder, like, ruin a family's life because it's a way of selling newspapers. And they're just like, well, that's the price you have to pay for freedom. If you want news, you're going to have to deal with us hacking your phones and, like, libeling random strangers and, like, digging in your bins to unearth all your private information. And if you say, what if you didn't do that? Well, you're a communist. You want to unearth, you know, you want to destroy the news industry and you want to censor everything. It's like, this is the real... And of course, that applies to, like, so many other things in society. It's like, what if you wanted a different economic system?
Well, no, but this is it, right?
Here's this massive barrier of the media elite saying there's no alternative.
There's absolutely no
alternative way of running things. Capitalism is the one and only way of organizing society, and that applies to the economy, the media, health, transport, how we get our food, how we conceive of ourselves as individuals. I think, like, media power is, and this is sort of my sort of main motivation for continuing to do this, is like, and it's actually a line that B has come up with, and it stuck with me for a long time. It's like, if you want a fairer and more democratic society, you have to start by transforming the media. Because all of in our current, like, communicative society, our audiovisual society, where so much of what we do in life goes through... You and I right now are talking through media, right? We're not sat in a cafe having a nice conversation. we're reliant upon a media, something in between us, to discuss the way we're going about things. Expand that to... how does the public talk about what kind of society it wants? Well, you have to go through conversations in newspapers and on TV platforms. Those newspapers and TV platforms aren't working. They're not allowing that kind of conversation. So if you want to build something different, you have to go through the media. And you can't go through the media unless you change it.
I often think about how also, if you look to other countries' histories and whatnot, like how much having control over media systems, over radio, etc., was like a really big part of being able to, like, claim autonomy, claim control, claim land even at times. Right? I thought that was really interesting. But onto this word, onto this fantastic and beautiful word that is mutualization, right? Because, you know, no one knows what the fuck that is. A lot of people, like you say, I think there's this very binary idea of either we do capitalism like this, or we do the state like this, and we have no freedom at all. We have this and da 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 da. And I think we have such, like, basic and simple and poor understandings of, like, the kind of political framework in which we exist in, right? The binary of left to right to center, the fact that center and right are in the same fucking camp, but whatever. I don't give a fuck about that right now. What I care about is seeing change. What I care about is something that is effective, that's pragmatic, that's real, that's taking, as you say, really into consideration what is happening in that bloody factory. So what does mutualization even mean? Let's start off there. What is that?
Yeah. Mutualization basically means an organization that is owned and controlled by its members. So it's run mutually, right? It's run for the mutual benefit of the people who are involved in that organization.
And how does that differ from co-ops?
Co-op is sort of like a subgenre of mutualization, right? They all sit within the same camp. So it's been a long time since I looked at, like, the sort of list of different forms of mutuals, but, right, a cooperative organization is a form of a mutualized organization. And I think that the difference is, cooperatives are typically referred to, it refers mostly to, like, businesses where you have
customers
and workers and shareholders.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. And I think why we had to land upon the unfortunately abstract term of mutualization for the BBC is, like, partly we didn't want to fall into that trap of, like, treating ownership of the BBC as being, like, a shareholder, or that you are a customer of it. Because I think that the notion of, like, public ownership of media has to go beyond this idea of commodification and actually be about a direct personal and humanizing and collective relationship between us as citizens and individuals, right? It is not just about, oh, we all have an equal sort of economic stake in the production of this good or the success of this shop or that our housing is all run for our mutual benefit. And obviously, like, all of those things have social aspects to them. It's not purely about economic ownership, but I think why we talk about the BBC being mutualized rather than as a co-op is partly because some of the criticisms of like the co-op sector are that, and this is not down to like cooperatives as a notion, this is down to like how specific cooperatives have been organized, is that more often than not, it becomes a structure where like the executives only sort of pay lip service to their existence as a co-op, right? We're owned and run by our members, which means that once a year you get to vote on what our salaries are. And the rest of the year, we'll continue to run the business in as much of a profit-seeking way as possible. That is not the only way that co-ops work, but that has, particularly in the UK, that is like...
Yeah, for like the big ones, right? Like when we think to, you know, we say co-op, people are thinking like, you know, the one with the blue logo, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like that's not what the local bike co-op looks like. Do you know what I mean? That's not what the sustainable like exchange / green type, I don't know, co-op is doing. Like it's not what the housing co-ops necessarily look like, which the, you know, there's a variety and diversity of ways in which people are going about that as well. So it's not what we mean, and it doesn't. And I think especially when thinking to like the co-op principles, we start to see those kind of like slide, and we start to see the ways that these like really, really big co-ops are not necessarily always meeting those. A lot more active in terms of like the desire for like social change, community good, sure, but not, as you say, in this kind of way that we're desiring in many ways. And also I think that profit incentive is something like really worth investigating, because the difference, as you say, the main difference being about membership, where the profit is going. But I think also questioning this like profit motive to begin with, I think, is always like something worth doing, and appreciating the different contexts in which that is like beneficial to a given community, and also appreciating the context in which it is not, right?
Yeah, which again I think is why applying those principles and ideals and like what kind of society do we want to have, and how could cooperatives or mutualization actually benefit it, looking at that through the lens of the BBC is like, I think, so potentially exciting, because again, to use a rather reductive term, you're talking about a different kind of product from what a lot of cooperatives produce. You're not talking about a commodity, you're talking about a social and cultural relationship with everybody else in society. And how can you produce that? And how can you make news and information and art and culture in a way that is genuinely something that belongs to all of us, rather than something that is produced by this big monolithic top-down institution, which claims to be doing it for the public benefit, but is in no way connected to or accountable to or responsive to the public itself. So that was the position we came to with the BBC, is like all of these principles of why is public media important? Because there are certain things about the ownership of information, the ownership of news and culture that matter to the functioning of a democratic society. You can't have a democratic society unless people have access to information, because there's no way they can make decisions about their lives. But a commercial organization of media does not produce the kind of news and information that is beneficial to that. That has always been the underlying principle. It's why we've had the BBC since 1922, even back in the 20s, when all of the people in power had this very, very paternalistic idea about, we are the people with the right stuff. We're the ones who determine what is good for the public and what isn't. And what's good for the public is a source of news and information that's actually for their benefit rather than just for making money. Even back then, they understood that the involvement of profit in the production of news and information was a bad thing. But like the way that, particularly in the last 30 years, that's a kind of managerial, and what we have to say is a neoliberal instinct has overtaken the BBC, where it's like, well, yeah, we can do these good fluffy things, but they have to be profitable and they have to not compete with the market. And if they do compete with the market, they have to step aside. There was one of these sort of ideas that stuck with me is a lot, and without going into like the real nitty gritty of how the BBC was like massively deformed over the last 30 years. But basically in the 1980s, in the wake of Thatcherism, a lot of these ideas started to seep into the BBC of like, markets work best. Public organization of stuff doesn't work. Markets are the way you have to organize things. So what if we organize the BBC like a market? But then all of the commercial sector was like, well, no, because if you organize the BBC like a market, then we'll lose all of our profits, because it'll be more successful at doing it than us. Because the BBC, like, if you have this, you know, a massive publicly owned piece of culture, which is owned and paid for by everybody, but is also operating in the market, that'll reduce our profits. So the idea came up, like, the BBC has to act more and more like a commercial media organization in its structure, in its regulation, in how it thinks about what it produces and whether it makes money or not. but it cannot tread on the toes of the market. So it's stuck in this double bind of like, you have to act like a commercial organization, but you can't compete with commercial organizations, which has led to a lot of like some of the BBC's core functions just kind of disappearing, because anytime the BBC wants to do something new or exciting, like expand into social media or provide sports coverage that means that like ordinary people can actually go and watch football matches on their TV instead of having to spend 100,000 million pounds for a season pass or 100,000 million pounds on a Sky Sports thing, all of these commercial regulations said, nope, you can't have that. The public cannot have free and open access to sport. The public can't have a non-corporate social media because that would tread on the toes of the market. So one of these opportunities the BBC had to become a more and more public, much more effective public organization were completely trampled by these commercial instincts. But like mutualization is basically trying to reclaim that instinct and say that rather than the BBC being defined by whatever the political desires of the government of the day are, the BBC should be shaped and controlled and managed by the people who pay for it, i.e.
Yeah, independent of the state. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what does that look like in practice? What do you outline and what do you propose? And keep it simple, keep it short.
Yeah. So I think the simplest way of saying it is like, instead of the BBC being managed by a bunch of elites and managers, and admittedly lots of very creative people within the BBC itself, what if the BBC's strategy was actually directly set by groups of the general public? So everybody would become a member of the BBC under mutualization, which means that you would then be given distinct powers and rights to shape the way the BBC is governed. There are two practical ways that works. The more specific and kind of like institutional one is this idea we have of panels, where throughout all of the BBC's operations, instead of decisions being made exclusively and behind closed doors by BBC executives and managers, you would have panels of BBC members, so members of the public, who would come in for long periods of time and be directly involved in shaping how the BBC does stuff. So that might be a panel of members of the public who decide what should the BBC's editorial approach to Gaza be, rather than it just being shaped by like very dubious figures with careers, like, you know, current BBC editors who used to serve in the IDF, or current BBC executives who have like direct links to the Conservative Party or the Labour Party. What if the editorial direction of the BBC's coverage of Gaza was actually shaped by conversations from members of the general public?
Right. What if your mum was the one that was on that?
What if your mum and 29 other people were involved in regular conversations with BBC staff? And BBC staff would be required to go to that panel and say, is what we're doing right? Do you feel like you're informed by this? What do you want to know more about? Are there aspects of this story you don't like or do like? And that panel would have direct authority to then say to the editors of the BBC, we don't like this, we want this to change. We want you to investigate this differently. So creating direct lines of accountability between the sort of the creative and journalistic people within the BBC, the staff of the BBC, who are doing the work of actually producing what the BBC wants to produce, and members of the public who'd be directly and actively involved in shaping, this is how we want these facets of the BBC to work. That's the kind of institutional way. And admittedly, that's like not very many members of the BBC would be involved in that, right? You could have 1,000 panels across the BBC designing all different ways of like, what is its production strategy? How does it produce children's television? What kind of playlist should Six Music have, and what kind of artists should they invite on? Actually involving the public in deciding how the BBC should organise its stuff. Like, that's still not service. Many people. It is jury service. I mean, that we've taken the principle of jury service very seriously, because it starts from this premise of like, you are here to have a civic duty to determine whether this person goes to prison or not. And I've done jury service, and admittedly, the other people you do it with are not very infused about it, because they just want to go back to work. They're having to give up like a week or 2 weeks' pay. It's very boring. They have to sit through. I took it very seriously. I was like, this is my civic duty, right? This is a major part of our society in determining, do you send somebody to prison or not? And that decision is in part given over to 12 randomly selected people from the local area. And that duty of like, you know, you are then as a juror given intimate and extensive access to all kinds of information about a crime that has taken place. And you are then given the individual and collective responsibility and decision to decide which way does that case go. Are they guilty or are they innocent? That principle of applying it to the BBC, of not just like a focus group of you watch BBC News for 20 minutes and then someone goes, so what did we think of that? It's like you would have a permanent and ongoing role in shaping not just one news story or a day of news stories, but like an ongoing editorial pattern of how the BBC shapes its output. And there wouldn't be any escape for the BBC staff, right? because the whole structure of the organization would be changed, that like, you're not accountable to the board. You're not accountable to government. You're accountable to the people who pay for the BBC to exist. And not just the people who pay for the BBC to exist, the people who you're producing this content for. They're not just your stakeholders, they're your audiences. If the people who you're producing news for don't like the news you're producing, you probably need to do something different. That line of accountability doesn't exist in the BBC at the moment. Mm-hmm. It's factored for all of these things like, well, as long as the Secretary of State is happy with the way we're doing things, that's fine. Or as long as my manager is happy with it, that's fine. The public has not been involved in how the BBC operates, ever. But it should be. And that's what we're trying to do with the panel system. The second element, the second kind of power and right, which is something that all of us would have, is having direct financial control over the BBC. So we all pay our license fee, and that money disappears out of our bank account. And in exchange, we get
sure,
some TV
we all pay for it.
We all pay for it. We all collectively...
Every single person.
We recognise that collective public investment in media is very important, and that's why we all pay... We all pay our licence fee.
Everyone.
Anyway, apart from that, right, people who do pay their licence fee, the money disappears out of their bank account, and in exchange they get access to some channels and some radio stations, and that's meant to be a great big public good. And actually, it's the principle of mutualisation is no taxation without representation. If you're not directly involved in this organisation, why are you paying for it?
Yes, sir.
But then it's also, if you're paying that money, you should be able to decide where that money goes. So yes, a big part of your money would go towards funding all of the large sort of big public service things at the BBC, but you would have kind of an individual slice of control, a control over your own individual slice of the BBC's overall budget. So once a year, you would be able to decide, I want my slice of the BBC budget to go towards this particular project. I want this journalist to have some of my public funding to go and do something particular. People have described this when we've talked about it on other podcasts or with like interviewers or whatever. It's a bit like a crowdfunder, right? The idea that like everybody who is a member of the BBC would be able to pitch a defined amount of money towards people's bids. So somebody says, I want to do a piece of reporting on homelessness in London, but the corporate newspapers aren't giving me money and no one else is giving me money. So they would come to a mutualized BBC and they would open up their project and they would say, I want members of the BBC to give me money so I can go and do this. And then members of the BBC, the general public, would be able to decide, I want to give my money to that project. I want to have a direct way of funding new pieces of public service content. I want to use my public investment in media to support this output. And then that, not only would that be like, oh, I'm just giving money to a crowdfunder, but then like that person would have all of the institutional resources and support of the BBC as a piece of public media. And then that piece of public media would go out on the BBC. So it's just a way of completely changing. We're calling it public commissioning, right? All of the commissioning power of what the BBC chooses to make belongs to a bunch of very, very well-to-do cultural elites who have lots of background in arts and TV production and so on and so forth. But they make their decisions based on what they think the people want to see. What if the people actually got to have a direct way of saying, this is what I want to see on the BBC, this is where I want my money to go?
Right, so what if your little brother could you know, inspire a TV show,
Why not? This is the thing. This comes up so many in conversations about, like, is the BBC, should the BBC exist in the modern media landscape when you have, like, TikTok celebrities and YouTube stars and so on and so forth? And, like, you look at the number of kids who try to get their own YouTube account going. I think there are more, like, I think every child over
myself
the last 10
included.
Years has tried to become a TikTok celebrity or a YouTube celebrity, right? Everybody at some point with these new technologies has attempted, because they think they're doing, they care about something and they want it out in the world.
About origami.
Yeah, and you want other people to benefit from it, and you want to show your skill or your expertise or something, and you want other people to benefit from it. But because of the like massive imbalances of power of the way that like the tech platforms work or any part of our media environment works, it's impossible for you to actually get that out there. What if there were a big public institution which opened its arms to you and said, we want all of the creativity and all of the inspiration and all of the crazy wacky ideas that people have a space where other people can see it and enjoy it, and also where you could get money from it, where people could say, I want to give my slice of my BBC funding to you so you can do this, and then we would all collectively benefit from you being able to share your origami skills with people through the BBC. Right?
It's Let's not do that.
But yeah, so those two powers are like what we see of, in essence, as the practical way that mutualization would work. The panels that give members of the public direct authority to shape the internal operations of how the BBC works. But then the individual power of public commissioning. I and you and everyone else would have the power to dedicate parts of our money towards projects that people want to make. So the BBC basically becomes a massive storehouse of like public creativity and interest.
That's really cool. I love that. How would we do the latter? Like, do we vote on shit? Do we go to our local? Also, like, is there, and I feel like this was spoken about briefly as well, Deb's mentioned this and her effort to also speak to devolution and to the fact that, you know, different nations, different priorities, different stories, and the fact that like something also, when I think to the panels, right, like you want the people that are, you know, randomly selected to also then be accountable, and like, oh, and there's also the regional aspect of like where are these people coming from, right? Like statistically a massive portion of the population is in London, but the thing is we don't all live in London, and you know what I mean, like how, in practice,
not to add another like ization term into the mix, but like the federalization of the BBC goes hand in hand with mutualization, right? And at the moment the BBC claims that like, well, we've got offices in Manchester and we've got offices in Glasgow, so we're very much representative of the people of Glasgow and the people of Manchester.
The North and the real North.
Yeah, exactly. But like under mutualization, the idea would be like, rather than it still being this national monolith that claims to represent the whole country from London, what if core parts of the BBC were actually broken out to people's local regions and communities? And what if we could then go to a local BBC newsroom that was then, everyone in that local area would have a right to go in and say, I live in this area, here's a BBC journalist working in this area, these are the stories I want you to cover. Or local commissioning of like, okay, well, every county or every region of the BBC or of the UK would then have its own dedicated part of like a kind of regionalized or sub-regional bit of the BBC that then people could go into and say, I live in this region, this part of the BBC exists to serve me, I want it to produce programs and art and culture that's specifically made for me and people in my region. So it's not just like, oh, everyone has, you know, all of these panels have to go to London, and they would be sort of like, they our proposal would be that they would be sort of representative of the makeup of the general public. But actually, you would still then also have like a Southwest panel or a Scotland panel or an Edinburgh panel or a Glasgow panel. Then you would give people within those communities the actual individual right to go into a BBC newsroom and say, I'm a member of the BBC, you're a BBC journalist, let's work together to work out what kind of news and culture we want to produce in this local area. So we're definitely not proposing that like the BBC then just becomes this big tower in London where all of these panels have to flock to and do everything on the basis of the UK. It's actually about breaking out the BBC and turning it into much more of a, yeah, like a federalized system of different individual parts of a broadcaster which we all own and control and can take part in.
Fuck yeah. I'm also thinking about the role of independent media in all of this as well, like the relationship, because presently, I can't speak for independent media, but you know, if I was working in independent media, I wouldn't like the BBC very much, you know what I mean? And in this new model, what would my relationship be to my own community, you know, whoever I'm representing, because I guess I'm using the example of independent media that is from a particular region, right? The importance of that independent media, how do these things play together, as it were, you know? I mean, like, again, in the realm of markets and competition and all of that, like, how does BBC and independence come together?
Yeah. And I think this, again, is something that it's a line that Deb said this when we last spoke about mutualization. And it's a line that stuck with me since, is thinking about the BBC not as like just an organization, but actually as a piece of social infrastructure, right? It's something that is spread all throughout the country, or should be spread all throughout the country. And it determines how we get access to information, art and culture about us and the world around us. And currently the way that infrastructure is organized is as like a single organization, right? So the conflict between independent media and the BBC is like, here are two competing organizations. You've got independent media that wants to produce news about its community. And then you've got this monolithic BBC that also wants to produce news about that community, but in a very sort of homogenized top-down way, or it just uses its financial clout to be like, well, we're producing local news in Bristol, so why would you need the Bristol Cable? And the Bristol Cable will say, well, obviously we do things very differently and we're actually only organized by our members. But having to compete against this massive like barrage of BBC produced news is very difficult for independent media. I think under mutualization, we see that relationship changing from being like competitors to cooperators and to partners. And like, you actually embrace this idea of the BBC being not just like an organization that you have to work at to get through the doors, but like a piece of infrastructure which everybody has a collective ownership and stake in. So independent media could go to their local BBC hub and say, we want to work together to produce this story. We want to use some of the BBC's like
resources, yeah.
The BBC's resources or its archives or its clout or its connections, and use our expertise and our connections and our embeddedness in the local community as independent media to do what, you know, the BBC supposedly wants to produce stuff that benefits the public. Independent media wants to produce stuff that benefits the public. Work together to do it and use the BBC's resources and use its infrastructure as a way to expand and improve and promote independent media. And that ties into this kind of crowdfunder thing of like giving individual people the right to distribute parts of their own BBC funding. Is independent media could go to a local newsroom and say, we need money for this project because we want to do a big piece of investigative journalism on like a scummy landlord or something that the council is doing wrong or why our bins aren't being collected, but we need the money to do it. That's not
you
just
always talk about the bins being collected. What, like, who hurt you?
Bins being collected is like, you know, if watch how quickly society collapses when bins don't
when
get
the
collected.
Bins aren't collected.
Yeah, it's very, you know, the Romans figured out that if you don't get rid of your waste, bad stuff happens.
Bad stuff.
Like rats the size of cats. But yeah, like this, the changing of the relationship between local independent media and the BBC, as from being like competing organizations to like the BBC being an open house, a piece of infrastructure that belongs to all of us and therefore should be something that we can all use collectively. And having that crowdfunder system be like, yeah, I want to do this piece of investigative journalism. And so I pitch to the local community saying, in this yearly round of you being able to dedicate your funding to something, please give it to me because I'm an independent media worker in your community and I want to do this. And rather than me having to set up my own massive enterprise of crowdfunding or me having to collect, you know, 1,000 people to give me £3 a month so I can do it, you get rid of all of that burden of someone having to individually crowdfund their own work, and you do it through the BBC as a piece of publicly owned infrastructure. And the BBC is there and says, we open up our arms and we open up our money for people who want to submit bids for important pieces of local journalism or public work. And BBC members can then decide, yeah, I do want to give my money to that person doing that big investigation on why my bin wasn't being collected. I'm fucking pissed off that my bin wasn't collected, and
yeah,
I want someone to report on it. Here's this independent person who's come to me asking for money, and I've got this slice of money that is dedicated to public media, so here it is.
And also on that, it means that when we do crowdfund for other projects, right, again, coming back to News Club, talk about news, what to do about it, right? This is like, you know, not, I mean, what you're suggesting obviously is talking about the news, engaging with the news, being particularly active, understanding it, as you say, as an infrastructure rather than something that we get in the general like zeitgeist of things and
it's not yet,
and products.
This is the
and
thing. News isn't just
consumption.
News and media isn't something that's just pumped at us. It's something that we should have a direct relationship with and be involved in and interact with.
Like, I think, who was it on one of the early episodes spoke about how essentially journalism no longer being the public square, but rather like a voice in it. And it's like how, I think in many ways I'm seeing this as like a recreation of that public square, where it's like no, like this is a medium through which we do things. This is not just like another product to consume. This is like vital to like how we politically engage and putting the word aside, right? It's just, it means that we have the power to do stuff, right? I think also the thing that really gets to me is this idea of bias, right? Like, we, you know, we will be releasing that series on media bias, I promise, but the biggest thing being that we have it, and it's not about whether, it's not about pretending like it's not there. It's about being really specific about what our bias is. And Bristol has every right to say our bias is to like support people, our bias is to make sure people live a good life and are able to eat well, are able to have their energy and their heating in their houses, and are able to have their bins collected, right? Like, the bias is towards whatever these desires are. No, it's your obsession. Now I've decided to adopt it. Dr. Chivers. But I would like to think that this then becomes something that very well facilitates what we talk about here, which is doing stuff about it, right? Infrastructure to say, okay, cool, like this is the problem, nice, now we have money to like go and change that. But also the attention economy, right? Now we have a great portion of the attention economy, one that is like far more led and engaged with the people, and therefore like far more incentivized to do something about it, right? A lot less powerless, a lot more connected, and also kind of normalizing and popularizing the mutualization concept to begin with, right? Even if people don't call it mutualization, just having an understanding that like you have the ability to directly participate. Again, bringing it back to democracy, accountability, community. Those are the three words that I'm saying is at the heart of what we talk about, what we care about here at News Club, and just generally what I care about.
But I think that goes to something very, a lot of the, so many of the conversations around, and like very general conversations around whether the BBC should still exist, people will just say, well, social media exists now. We all have the power to make our own media. We all have the power to like select our own news sources. We don't need someone on high from telling us what the important news is anymore, because I can go on Twitter or Instagram, pick my sources, and get the news that's perfectly designed for me. Or if I so choose, I can become a producer of news and I can go out there and I can like report stuff that matters to me. So this whole like veneer of democratization on social media, people are like, well, you know, why do we need these monolithic structures anymore when social media has allowed us to democratize the media space? But like, obviously for anybody, that democratization is just like a complete scam, because unless you are
absolutely
like a, you know, majorly abusive viral TikTok star who just like spews out crap, or you're just someone who's like attracted a massive base because you're Andrew Tate or you're like Nigel Farage or whatever, or, you know, even a left-wing equivalent of that, where like by just the grace of you capturing a
by the grace of God,
by the grace of God, you have captured a particularly large audience. Like, that may be good for that one particular influencer, but that's impossible for everybody else. Like, the barriers to entry of being a success on social media are as tough as they are for opening a massive national newspaper or becoming a major broadcaster.
Absolutely. Like, I think going back to the like this theme of democracy, right? And beyond that, I said the same thing yesterday to someone where it's like, we seemingly have made this distinction between like individual well-being and collective well-being. And there's this other creator, really cool work. There's this video that's really stuck with me by them since I've engaged with them, is Matthew Gwendolyn, because they speak about how a lot of people in their financial meeting or in advance of their financial meeting, because they're entirely supported by like direct donations and support from like the public and from people. And I really love how they frame themselves as being accountable to those people who give them money directly, right? An element that was mentioned here is the fact that in light of their biggest like supporters in terms of like financial support, many are concerned with their well-being as an individual, as a person, as someone who's like spending so much of the resources that they get on this work. And they make a really important point, which is that their well-being is directly tied to the well-being of the people that they're like working with and supporting and having these projects with. Like me taking this money is not going to make me feel better, right? I mean, me spending some of this on a new MacBook, I mean, it would be convenient, it's not going to make me feel better. What's going to make me feel better is like seeing other people do better, live well and be free. Like that's what's going to make me feel better. Like that is what is tied to my spiritual well-being. Like they didn't phrase it like this, but I thought it was, that's how I'm phrasing it. That's how I see it. God, I've gone off on a bloody tangent.
No, but not at all, because all of those same ideas apply to how we feel about the media environment and like what kind of news and information we're getting about the world around us. Because again, the whole media environment is currently structured on this basis of like media is something that's done to you by large companies and organizations and like very well-paid journalists or like influencers. And actually we need to change that relationship away from media is something that's done to you and media is something that you have an active and direct part in shaping, because of exactly what you've just said, those collective benefits, the way that like if we want the people around us to like flourish and enjoy life and be able to understand the
and
decisions
if we want
that
to
they're
flourish,
making
yeah.
And if we want to flourish and we want to see the world around us, you know, actually feel that we have some connection to the world around us rather than it's something that's being done to us, then having a media institution in which we play an active and direct role is really the only way we're going to do that. Because again, social media is like, oh, it's democratic, you can see what you like and do what you like, but like you can't change anything on there. You don't have any real power to shape
we don't own those platforms, we don't determine the ownership.
I mean, obviously the ownership is the core of the reason, but like the actual our interaction with it is me posting something doesn't actually change my relationship with the platform. It doesn't change my relationship with other people.
News shouldn't just be in this kind of like online sphere either, right? Like this infrastructure offers an ability for people to walk into a bloody building, to touch grass, to have meetings outside, to like be more connected to their communities. And I think that's also what I mean when I say collective well-being. It's like now you get to speak to people. We always say this, like, just, you know, spend some time off your phones. But like, that is not something I can do and know that that will change the world. Like what I can do in parallel and also encouraged by this framework within which we can actually like make that happen. I think that's really cool. I think that's really powerful. I think that's why when we start with a collective, we will always like address the individual. When we give and we give and we give, we will always receive in that exchange. I love that.
Yeah, I think that's really the core of mutualization. And it's why I think the again, to come back to like the kind of politics of it, is doing this through the BBC is possibly the only opportunity we have to do it, because trying to start that conversation from the ground up when you already have a set of institutions and corporations that are militating against any idea that you could take ownership of the media away from oligarchs and the Murdochs and the Rothermeers and from like corrupted elites and sort of client lobby journalists in Westminster. Like, you're not going to be able to do that from the ground up. You have to take this infrastructure and this institution that already exists, that already claims to have. You know, what we'll see during Charter Review is all of these like glossy adverts from the BBC saying it's our BBC or it's your BBC. And of course it isn't. We don't have any actual direct control over what it does. But if there's this body that has within it somewhere this like scintilla of an objective to serve the public, then okay, let's take that to its fullest extent. Let's take this institution that is a public service broadcast. And again, I have to, when I'm in conversation with politicians, and they say the term, well, I love public service broadcasting. It's like you've weirdly not put the emphasis on the word public there. You love the emphasis on service and broadcasting, but you always seem to skirt over the idea that the first word is public. And unless the public are actually involved in this process, you can't claim for it to be a public service broadcaster. So that's kind of the root of mutualization, is like, if we want all of these high-minded ideals about media that serves the public to work, then you have to give it to the public for them to organise it on their own terms and to actually give them real power and accountability over how it's organised. Because if you don't do that, again, in a, like a kind of raw, immediate political sense, Charter Review happens, there's some sort of fuddled compromise where maybe the BBC gets a little bit more money, but in exchange it's like massively put into more control of commercial regulation and state interference and so on. And then over the next couple of years, licence fee payers will turn around and say, well, where's my stake in this? Why should I continue to fund this organisation that has no connection to me in my life? All the rest of the media environment is claiming to do stuff for me. I can choose what I watch on Netflix. I can choose who I follow on social media. And here's the BBC that I'm ostensibly required to pay for that has no connection to me and it's not accountable to me and I have no control over it. Why should I? That will be my position as someone who like is one of the biggest advocates of public media and the, like trying to maintain something like the BBC in the future. If Charter Review passes without like any kind of real public control, I'm not going to keep funding it because it that has no relationship to me and my interests and the way I want to organise the media landscape. It will just be another large, mostly corporate institution managed by and owned by and operated for elites, except I'll be required to pay for it. And I will say, thank you very much, but no, see you later.
Yeah. And I think it's also interesting, I guess, in light of like the present moment, it's kind of now or never in some ways, right? Either this happens or it doesn't. And it is a massive shame, as you say, because we can't build that kind of infrastructure, right? Like that's decades. That's like, as you say, a century of existence.
Yeah, we have to go back to the 90s and do it all over again.
It's exactly. And I think, I don't know, I think I also sit with some pessimism. I'm like, what's the likelihood of them adopting this mutualization structure, right? Like it doesn't benefit them. I think I'm always going to like criticize any approach that's kind of like, you know, pleading for the higher ups to like change how they do things because, you know, I asked really, really nicely and we're all begging and enough of us, you know. And
I think this is, we do have, and I this is something we'll have to really push hard, like me specifically as a campaigner that'll be on the edge of this, as well as all the other people who are going to be involved in Charter Review, is like, we have a relatively strong political bargain to make with them, whether that's the government or like sort of liberal defenders of the BBC who'll be like, oh, you know, I like the BBC, but let's not meddle with it too much. Is like, if you don't do this, it will go. If in your own interest, if you're someone who wants to see the BBC continue, if you talk about like, oh, it's wonderful soft power in the world, or all the lovely creative things it produces that puts Britain on the map.
Like even like BBC Global, like imagine being able to like have power over that as well, right?
Yeah.
And also kind of like extrapolating it out into like this international sphere, because, you know, obviously we're talking about the nation in many ways. We're talking about ownership coming from a particular nation, but I think it really does open the door to then say, oh, actually, this is something, an infrastructure that is also determining, affecting and providing. Who was I was speaking to that was the sort of the Media Reform Coalition's Media Democracy Festival, whereby someone was mentioning that they really, what they valued about the BBC was the fact that like it does offer news in other languages, the translation services. Like, I don't think people really come to like conceptualize how big that is, how much time that's taken to create. And if you could just have this moment of structurally transforming and yet maintaining its like existing branches of what it has the power to do, of the capacity that it holds, that's so cool. And it opens the conversation up to say, actually, we're not the only people that should have control over this infrastructure, right? Like it is, you know, I think I can't wait to like have Debs on and speak maybe a bit more about this idea of a media commons, right? Like how this then expands like beyond the nation state, I think is vital, right? Like, because I think we speak as though it's either state or capital, a bit of both, but I'm like, you know, no, it could be neither. And that's cool.
I agree.
That's really
and
it, cool.
Again, to come back to the, because like, those exciting conversations I think should motivate us to follow this through, but like
it excites me and I didn't give a fuck before.
the political challenge, basically we have to take the question of like, who is going to be the one that's holding the gun to the BBC's head? Is it going to be Nigel Farage and Reform and Elon Musk in like 5 years' time when they inevitably sweep to power and just decide, yep, like, you know, someone could just reform the BBC now on a very, very moderate basis of like, oh, you know, we'll tinker at the edges and we'll change this and we'll change that and the license fee goes up or it goes down. And unless that fundamentally changes people's public relationship with it, then the ongoing trend of people just not caring about the BBC, not feeling a stake in it, not wanting to pay for it, will carry on regardless of whatever shiny gloss you try and put on it. So that is then just...
be holding that gun.
Yeah, like you can't save the BBC, you have to transform it. Because at the moment, it is Farage and Musk holding the gun over the BBC. We need to take that gun out of their hands and say, if you don't reform it for us and make it a public organisation that's owned and controlled by us, then we will simply walk away from it, and then we'll hand the gun back to Farage, and this, you know, pillar of the state will just be deleted overnight. Or probably, I do think more realistically, Farage will keep it, but privatise a lot of it, and basically keep the core BBC News as, like, a state broadcaster, because that's all that authoritarians and populists do, is they, you know, you only have to look to, like, Hungary or the US and just see, like, they, you know, it's not... It's never the wet dream of like uber libertarians where they're like, this guy's going to come in and he's going to sell it all off. Well, they don't. They sell most of it off and then they keep a last little bit because they love state power and they love state propaganda because that's how they get into power in the first place. So I think that's what we can look forward to with Farage. The alternative is we say, you give it to us, you give it to everybody, so that in 5 years' time, whoever comes into power, they can't touch it because it belongs to us. It's now our institution. It's not an institution that exists on the gift of whoever is the Secretary of State at the time. It's an institution that exists because it's owned and controlled and directly funded by the members, i.e. the entire British public.
Love it. Love it. And that's what it is, right? It's about ownership. It's about ownership. It's always about ownership. I love how that concept sometimes dissolves as well when we talk about it within a collective sphere. But, you know, we're like 1 hour 15 into this. And I think it's probably time to allow like a chapter two to emerge from this conversation, because there is a lot of questions, I think, about like, you know, that people probably think about in terms of the pragmatics, in terms of like, oh, what about this? What about that? I'm worried about this. But then I think to myself, like, those worries aside, I just know that whatever we're offering here is better than what exists. And for me, that's what matters above all, you know. And of course, you have your reports, you've got a lot more detail in there. People can ask questions, people can provoke, people can expand on it. I think that's important. I think it's important to be able to ask those questions, though perhaps not today.
Well, right. I mean, you know, eventually in very kind of boring, like, political realities, like Charter Review will start at some point very soon. We keep being told by the government it'll be in the summer, it'll be in the late summer, it'll be in the autumn, it'll be in the winter. I think they'll literally release it.
It's already,
But it's happening behind the scenes already, even though the official process hasn't started. Like, all of the lobbying and the goes, all of the pieces are being moved into place. And we see this especially around Gaza, where, like, Lisa Nandy has basically become like a fifth columnist for the Israeli government in saying, like, how dare the BBC say anything remotely critical about Israel, or how dare it feature a Palestinian child in its broadcast? Don't you know they're literally a terrorist? So the culture secretary is doing more than her work to line up what she wants to be the core political conversations about the future of the BBC. It'll be oriented around, should we bother to pay for it? Shouldn't Amazon and Netflix and Google take over all the authority? And why are they so bloody mean to Israel? Don't they know how lovely Israel is? Like, this is the time where actually we want to start moving our own pieces onto the board and making sure that different conversations take the meat of Charter Review, so that when it does become an official process, some of these conversations are part of it and we're not on the back foot being like, oh fuck, Charter Review's here, we've got to like try and get it onto the agenda. So that's why we tried to publish this so early, is because we knew it was coming up. And we knew that if this proposal wasn't out in the wild and people weren't aware of it, then people would sort of be surprised by Charter Review. Oh yeah, shit, the BBC, that's like something we can maybe influence. Yeah. How do we do
like,
that?
And we have, here's the answer, here it is. It really is about like the public support for it. It really is about saying to all these campaigners, to all these organizations, to anyone who gives a fuck, to say, here is an opportunity. Here's an opportunity to like own infrastructure that is existing, but presently not ours. Here's an opportunity to shift into like another era of like, of potential, of opportunity. It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. So last thing, what would you bring to the online news club? Because on the 20th of September in the year of our Lord 2025, we'll be hosting the first news club live. So what would you bring?
What do I bring to an event in September?
An online news club. So publications or creators, topics, movements, a physical object such as a fidget toy. What would you bring?
I think by that point, Yeah, I'd bring snacks, maybe a hip flask with some spirit or something, making a very lively news club. I think by that point, you know, there will have been movements in like stuff around like the hacking scandal. There's going to be a new ITV documentary about that, which will be interesting to talk about. Maybe some of the BBC stuff will have unfurled by then. We might have some new publications or like pamphlets around that to discuss. Mostly it'll just be fun to talk about what's in the news that week, which, as intelligent as I am as a doctor, I can't tell a month in advance what's going to be in the news on that day. The day is, sorry, say it again.
20th of September.
The 20th of September for the
I believe we said 3 p.m. I should probably double check that, though.
Yeah, so what will ever be the news that week, I will talk about. But there may be some stuff to bring along. I'll keep it close to my chest. I don't want to spoil the surprise. People have got to be kept in anticipation.
God forbid you spoil. God forbid.
Yeah.
Yeah, 2 p.m., not 3 p.m. Sorry, okay. Lads. 2 p.m. I should know that. Right. Well, okay. And I think we've already kind of addressed this. We've talked about Farage, and this is the question, the last question. In 2029, we may live in Europe and UK that was run by authoritarians. I think we can, you know, with relative confidence say that that's almost definitely going to be the case, not just a maybe, but almost a certainty. And I don't speak from pessimism, but just from observation. What is the one thing everyone should do leading up to 2029? I think we have our answer. I think that's been answered, but just to reiterate.
Yeah, I mean, one of the answers is like recognize that there is this before 2029, in the next 2 years, there is this huge opportunity for us to actually to seize control over a major piece of our media infrastructure, and trying to take, this doesn't have to be on the basis of like, hold your nose and love the BBC. It's like, no, the BBC sucks, but we can change it. We can do something different with it. And this is the opportunity now. So come out with all your guns blazing about all the things you hate about the BBC, but recognize that it can be organized differently. Mutualization might not be the model, but it's a model we can look at. And recognizing that we can do something different with this infrastructure before 2029. Because again, if we don't do it by 2029, then we're going to have to be looking at entirely different kinds of infrastructure or organization to fight back against whatever's in power then. Because yeah, this sort of chance to change the BBC before that eventuality happens is going to be huge. If it doesn't happen, then we're going to have to look to our own more sort of, you know, community-based projects, and hope that by building up those community-based projects, we can create a kind of own alternative architecture of a media.
And I mean, we should be doing that anyways, right? Yeah. Like, we should be doing that anyways. But as we said before, like, it would offer an opportunity to tie it into essentially like a really strong funding source, right? Like, I think for me as well, it's about the money. It's about being like we need to be able to like pay for this thing. We need to be able to like understand this as an exchange. And it's not the only economy within which we can engage, you know. I can't wait to hopefully
and again, like,
do an
really
episode on the gift economy.
Not want to get
well.
Into the economics, but actually the very basic economics of public media is like, it's cheaper to fund stuff publicly if you don't have a profit incentive. If you pay for Sky TV, much of what you're paying is going to the profits of the executives or to shareholders. Whereas
your energy bill, like, it's ridiculous. Yeah. Everything is like, yeah, it's not that expensive. It's really, when we change this infrastructure, we're saying it's going to be cheaper. Like, it just is.
I'm nice to hear you endorse the license fee as being nice and cheap. And that's why you pay it immediately.
Immediately. Every time.
Yeah.
Every year. Do you pay it every year? Is that a yearly thing?
I pay it quarterly.
Quarterly.
There are many interesting ways that you can pay your license fee that save you money.
That's crazy. All right, go pay your license fee, you know, follow, like, subscribe, I don't know. We're at newsclub UK_. All relevant links to reports and things mentioned, such as the Media Reform Coalition, will be in the description of this episode. But yeah, check out our podcast episodes prior to this one. And also subscribe to the newsletter, because this doctor right here is the writer of that newsletter, that bi-weekly newsletter with some brilliant witty titles that stick with us to this day, that we love you for to this day. Thank you for your time. Thank you for this absurdly long episode, which I've thoroughly enjoyed and did not want to stop at any moment. And I will see you soon, Thomas Chivers. Yes. Tom Chivers, Dr. Chivers.
Bye.
Bye.